about him and were taught in him, as the truth is in Jesus, to put off your old self, which belongs to your former manner of life and is corrupt through deceitful desires, and to be renewed in the spirit of your minds, and to put on the new self, created after the likeness of God in true righteousness and holiness. So that's a great passage to kind of frame our thinking this morning. Will you join me as I pray for us? Father, I thank you that you have granted us this time together this morning. And I do pray that you would, through the things we're going to think about and talk about this morning, put us on a trajectory where we are increasingly being conformed to your likeness, approving of what you approve of, living our life, having put on the new self, having put off the old corrupted self governed by deceitful desires. God, make us a people who not only press forward in the path of what is righteous and holy, but who delight to do that from our heart. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, this is our second week. There are notes for the first week, as well as a, sort of a summary of PowerPoint slides on our website. So if you weren't here and want to avail yourselves of that, you're welcome to do so. I do have a couple of, I think I put 10 copies of last week's notes back there, but they are available online. So this week, I want to just take a few minutes to highlight the main points that we covered from our first lesson. Then I want us to spend some time connecting the power of story to our own experience. Then we'll explore how worldview messages work in popular media. That's a really important thing to get a grasp of. And then finally, I hope to begin to develop with you a framework, a biblical framework for engaging entertainment responsibly. So that's what I'm hoping we can do together this morning. So let's just go over quickly some of the things that we covered last week by way of summary. So we started out exploring why entertainment is a relevant topic. And so we talked about how media and entertainment just has a huge footprint in our lives in terms of hours of television, streaming movies and music consumes. On average, 3.5 plus hours of streaming services per day for every American. We looked at teens who even consume more daily screen time, 8.5 hours. Social media, just TikTok and Snapchat alone take over 3 hours of a typical teen's day. And video gamers probably spending close to close to 2 hours a day. Young adults aged 19 to 24 are spending less screen time, but are actually streaming more. So it goes from 3 hours to 5 hours. So if you're in your early 20s, your peers on average are spending over 5 hours a day streaming some kind of entertainment or media for their intake. So, and then we spent a little bit of time looking at why this is a controversial topic, and there's a number of reasons just in terms of what is the moral and ethical content of things that are being watched. Does it really have that much of an influence on our behavior, and so should we be concerned about it? Questions about Christian freedom versus, is there a moral standard? Is there any kind of line that we draw that says this is not okay? So there's some controversy about how we talk about that. The addictive or distracting nature of certain kinds of online content or media makes this an issue that is prone for some conflict among families as those conversations take place. Parental concerns when your school is mandating that your kids are watching certain content, it's just an expectation. If your kid is invited to a party or something that's going to involve watching a movie or something, do you want your kid participating in or not? And how do you navigate those conversations with your kids' peers or their parents? So that can make this a controversial topic. And then just theological differences about what does the Bible say is right and what does the Bible say is wrong. And that can cause people to take different stances on what is allowed or not allowed or good or not good in terms of entertainment. So there is some controversy that's associated with this topic, which means we should probably talk about it. We should probably figure some things out in terms of our own thinking and how are we going to engage others on this arena that is so prominent in all of our lives in one way or another. So then we spent some time, we clarified our disposition toward entertainment. So we talked about a spectrum of people from the positive engager all the way down to the avid abstainer and kind of encourage you to take, okay, where do you fall in that? That will help you understand what's your disposition toward entertainment choices, but also hopefully help you engage with others who may fall in a different place, maybe coming at the topic with a different perspective. And so just being mindful of that can, I think, give us more constructive interaction with one another. And then we looked at the primary aims of class, which was, I'm not here to give you a list of the do's and don'ts, the you can watch this movie and you can't watch this movie. So if that's what you're hoping for, you're going to be disappointed. But I am hoping that we'll be equipped to better grasp entertainment's influence, to provide a biblical framework for our entertainment choices, to offer some practical tools to God-honoring entertainment decisions, and also to facilitate some mutually beneficial discussion with one another on the topic of entertainment. So then we looked at, we worked toward a definition of entertainment. Remember, we sort of had several different kinds of activities, and we asked, how do we determine if this is entertainment or non-entertainment? And we looked at a number of factors there, and then I put forth this sort of working definition. It's not the end-all of end-alls, but at least it kind of gets us on the same page, a diverse range of activities, experiences, and content designed specifically to engage and amuse individuals, eliciting enjoyment, pleasure, or satisfaction. So that's pretty broad, and that would encompass a lot of kinds of entertainment, from board games to movies to football or, you know, whatever you're doing. But for this class, I'm really going to focus more on kind of the passive screen-oriented entertainment. Not because the other stuff isn't relevant. I actually think a lot of what we talk about will apply to those other things as well. But I think in our current context, what's really dominant and maybe controversial is what are we doing with the stuff that's coming at us from the screen? So that's going to be more of the focus in our class. And then finally, we spent some time looking at how does the Bible address entertainment. So we said, you know, there's not really a lot of verses that explicitly talk about what are you supposed to do for entertainment. Maybe two or three even have the word entertain in them, and not all of those are even relevant. But we did determine that the things that we're engaged, involved in doing, like what we do with our eyes, what we do with our ears, what's happening in our mind, what desires we're feeding as we're being entertained, these are all things that the Bible speaks to quite a bit. And so if we have an eye for that, then we can begin to ask the question, okay, what does the scripture have to say about a particular aspect of how we entertain ourselves? So we looked at a number of verses that were oriented to what are we doing with our eyes, and what are the moral implications about what's happening in our eyes and our heart and our mind, and that kind of got us started with how does the Bible address the whole issue of entertainment. So that's kind of last week in a nutshell, 5-minute overview. Let's then kind of jump into this week. And I want us to begin just by asking the question, how does the power of story connect with our own experience? So think for a second of a scene in a movie or a book that had a particular impact on you. And so just want to, you know, take a second to call that to mind, what that might be. And then think with as much detail as you can, what do you remember about that scene? Can you think of the colors, the sights, the sounds, the emotions? What's going on there? So any thoughts? Any of you have a scene in mind that you're willing to share? Yeah, go ahead. Okay, so the movie Up. It's a Disney Pixar movie, I think, about a guy that floats in a house on a bunch of balloons to South America. Is that right? Okay, yeah. Yeah. Realistic. Okay.
Really hit in that it's a couple that gets together and you see them throughout their lives growing old, and they're trying to save up money to go on this vacation, and something happens, something breaks, they have to pay for it.
Yeah.
They can't have kids, so they grow old together. Eventually, the wife, I think, passes away from
him. Yeah, that's right.
And so he's left alone. Yeah, that every time I watch that.
Okay.
Tears.
Yeah, right. So I don't know the last time. What's your name?
BJ.
BJ? I don't know the last time you watched that movie, but clearly something connected. So you can probably envision all those cutscenes they have of all those incidents, right? The broken arm or leg, I think, or the car wreck, or, you know, and they're continually crashing their coin jar to take all their savings for this trip they want to take and spend them on stuff of life, and they never get to do the big thing that they wanted to do, right? Okay, good. Anyone else? Yeah.
I think of the scene in Lord of the Rings where Frodo and Sam are lamenting the struggles that they've endured so far. They're kind of captured, and they're not sure if they're going to be able to continue forward, and they seem to be faced with this insurmountable obstacle, and they're wondering, like, you know, how do we keep going on? And Sam just utters the line, you know, that we believe that there's something good in this world, and it's worth fighting for.
Okay.
It kind of used as a, just to help them turn that corner.
Yeah, okay, great. So J.R. Tolkien's series, The Lord of the Rings, I'm not sure which movie that scene comes in, but Frodo and Samwise Gamgee, they have this endearing loyalty and friendship as they go on this quest, and so what was the line? Tell me again, something, paraphrase it.
What are we fighting for? And says that there's some good in this world and it's worth fighting for.
Okay. Yeah, so there's some good in this world, and it's worth fighting for. And probably you can almost envision parts of that scene and call that to mind. Good. Anyone else want to venture? Yeah.
Going way back, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Oh,
okay, was it a silent movie, or was it...
imagine this, you know, the struggles of life as you go through it, not being able to do that big thing, and then you can feel or empathize with that sadness of not being able to get to do that, or I feel that, you know, this world is heavy and I have to fight against evil and there's something good in here, in the world, that I want to fight for, like you can kind of put yourself in the shoes of that character.
Yeah, great, okay, good. So, I forgot to advance the slide, there's a pretty little slide helping you guys imagine seeing the book in the movie. Yeah, go ahead.
In the movie, Boys in the Boat, there's a part where these guys are all rowing together and they're trying to win, and it's they're focusing as a team, and the whole scene is about the emotional angst and the investment, the hope, the anxiety, the worry, but also that we're in this together.
Kind of. Okay, all right. And so why did that connect with you? Why do you remember that?
Probably because there are things in life where I have a hope for, you know, it's like that feeling of you hope. Sometimes you're praying about something and you really, really want to see this happen, or you're praying for a person and you hope when you're watching things and you don't know what the end's going to be.
Sure.
But you're hoping that it turns out well.
Yeah.
That you win.
So sometimes a scene will embody the struggles or hopes that we have, and so we connect with it because it relates to our own life experience. Well, let's kind of have this at a different angle. There's I want us to study a passage in 2 Samuel 12, and I've included in the notes verses 1 through 6. And I'm going to read this, and I want you to be asking the question, why the story that Nathan told David produced the response that it did for David, okay? So God sends Prophet Nathan to to tell King David a story, okay? And so let's read this and now just ask, why does this story impact King David the way it does, all right? So it says, and the Lord sent Nathan to David, and he came to him and said to him, there were two men in a certain city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had very many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he had bought. And he brought it up, and it grew up with him and with his children. It used to eat of his morsel and drink from his cup and lie in his arms, and it was like a daughter to him. Now there came a traveler to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare for the guest who had come to him, but he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. Then David's anger was greatly kindled against that man, and he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, that man who has done this deserves to die, and he shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and because he had no pity. Right? Okay. So, why did David respond the way he did to that story, do you think? What is it about that story?
He's been a shepherd. He had lambs and stuff, probably some from his experience.
Okay. Well, lots of people have lots of lambs. What's wrong with that?
This guy was attached to him. He was probably attached to them as well.
Okay. So he had his own stuff, but then the other guy just had one. So why do we respond to that? Yeah.
I think everybody can realize what's wrong, and something clearly that you see in something someone else is so easy to spot, like, wow, that is wrong. So it's like your heart just goes, that's not right, you know? So it's like your soul is like just calling out, it knows what's
wrong. Okay. So as you sort of see or hear the scene unfold, there's a sense, might even say intuitively, but there's a sense in which what's going on here is wrong. Right, and David is responding to that. And any other ideas about why David responded?
When Scripture describes David as a man after God's own heart, and clearly that means that he would also be about justice.
It's okay.
A good idea of what is just and what is not, but he's blind to his own, unfortunately.
Yeah, good. So kind of building off of what Brenda said, we all have a sense of right and wrong, what's just and unjust. Now, we may not agree on how we draw those lines, but all of us have a sense of this is good or bad. Even the most libertarian people that I know who think you should be able to just do what you want to do, if their car gets stolen and taken off somewhere, there's a line there that says, nope, that, you know, you can't just take my car, even if you can do whatever you want to do, right? So we all have a sense of a framework of right and wrong in one way or the other. Okay, well, so clearly, Nathan comes in, and he gives this story, it's a parable, really, about a rich man that takes a poor man's only lamb and feeds it to his guests, right? Okay, so let's look at this now from a different angle. Why don't we just have the story like this? All right, it's basically the same. The Lord sends Nathan to David. Nathan tells David a parable about a rich man and a poor man. The rich man takes the poor man's only lamb to prepare a meal for a slaughter or for a traveler. David becomes very angry at the rich man in the parable and declares judgment. David suggests that the man who did this deserves to die and should restore the lamb fourfold. So contrast there, right? Story on the one hand and a statement of the facts on the other. Why didn't the writer just give a statement of the facts? Why the story? What's different about the two?
Well, yeah. For one thing, you've left out the details.
Left out the details. All the gory details. Well, they're not gory, but, okay. Why do we care about the details?
Women want the details.
The women want the details, okay. So whoever wrote that obviously had women in view, right? Good. Any other thoughts?
Impact.
The impact?
The impact of the story sticks with you.
Okay, all right. So the story somehow connects and sticks with us differently than just a statement of facts. Is that Mermaid?
I was just going to say the same thing.
Okay.
Because without the impact of the story, it doesn't hit us the same.
Yeah.
A good writer wants you to get drawn in to the character, to what's happening, to feel, to be there.
Okay. All right. So somehow we can enter into the what is being described in a story in a way that is different from just being given a list of the facts, right? So let me just mention a few things. Why is story so powerful? And some of these have already been mentioned, so I won't spend a whole lot of time with them. But stories are inherently, we might say, entertaining, but they certainly capture our attention. They spark curiosity. What's going to happen next? What was this person thinking when they did that? How's that person going to respond? So story invites us to pay attention, and it provides a more enjoyable, engaging way of looking at information that we might want to get. We can personally identify often with the main character, right? With their triumphs and their challenges, their flaws and their virtue. So this is something where hearing a story and seeing, oh, this person's doing this, right? Like, I don't know, do you identify with the poor shepherd who had only one lamb, or do you identify with the rich man who, had a lot but then took the other person's traveler? One of my favorite movies is a movie called Fiddler on the Roof. Some of you might be familiar with it. It's about a Jewish family in a Jewish community, and he has all these daughters, and it's all about the challenges of how a father navigates a challenging, changing social landscape, and his daughters wanting to break with tradition as they go about finding their man and getting married, right? And so I identify with two characters in that movie. One, I identify with the father, you know, who's the poor farmer, the poor milkman guy who's got all these daughters to provide for, doesn't have any money, and he's trying to do the best for them, and so prospects aren't great. But then they don't sort of respect him in his fatherly role and do things the way he thinks they need to be done. So that's one of the big sort of plot lines in the story. I also, however, identify with the poor tailor who has nothing to give to get this woman that he loves, you know. There's a line, I won't quote it exactly, but at some point he's trying to get up the gumption to ask the father if he can have the father's daughter for his wife, you know, and um, and he's just being kind of timid. He's a little bit of a shy guy, but at some point he burst out in his exasperation. But even a poor tailor is a should have some joy or something like that, right? So even a poor tailor is entitled to some joy, you know. I relate to that character and just feeling like, you know, even if I'm poor, does that mean that, you know, that there's nothing good for me? I identify with those characters in different ways. So personal identification is a huge part of story. Emotional resonance, we've talked about this. Stories engage our emotion and our heart in ways that are different than if we're just hearing a reading of the facts. Relatability, so stories make information available that we then relate to our own context, and so we can understand what's being said in a story, often in ways that we don't understand in the same way if they're just raw facts. And then finally, there's a cultural connection that that stories often make. So they include not just identifying with the individual character, but with a social context, a broader struggle within a community. And that draws us in because we can say, not only do I identify with this individual, but identify with the struggle that's going on in this community or in this family or in this nation, and it helps us to get situated in our own culture as we look at the struggles that are going on around us. So those are just some of the things why story can be really powerful, and we see story, narrative, employed a lot even in the scriptures. God uses story to connect with us in a way that's different than just stating the facts of what you should do and shouldn't do, what's right and what's wrong. With that in view, let's think about what are some of the values or beliefs that are embedded in the story of Samuel. Think about that. Okay, so it connects with us. We identify, but when the person who wrote 2 Samuel 12, when they wrote this, what were the beliefs or values that they intended to pass on to those of us who would read it? Any thoughts? What are some things that they are asserting are true about the world or valuable in the world?
Someone else's property.
Okay, so it's wrong to take something that's not yours. Good. Anything else? Yeah.
People are selfish and they take what they want even if they have enough already.
Okay, so speaks to a reality that people, even if they have all that they want, can be greedy and take something from someone else. Any other thoughts? Yeah?
Be done.
Justice, okay. There's an important element that there is justice and it should be carried out. Good. Well, let me just run through a few things that I kind of pulled out. There is a sense of divine justice. So this comes in the context of David and his sin of adultery with Bathsheba and his murder of her husband, right? And so God sends Nathan the prophet to confront David over the sin. So there's a sense that God is pursuing what is just. There is a repugnance to injustice. We feel that this is wrong, what this person did to take this person's only land. There's a sense of moral accountability. If you do something wrong, there are consequences that should follow to that, right? That's embedded, it's assumed in the story. There is also a sense of compassion and empathy. We're meant to look at this poor man who has only one shepherd and him losing that, and we're meant to feel empathy and compassion. Like, that's awful that happened, that was allowed to happen to such an individual, right? So that's a truth, an assertion that's being made, a value that's being forwarded in this story. There's a sense of equity before God here, right? So it doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor, king or not king, whatever. It doesn't give you the right by your station in life, your class in society, to just do whatever you want, to take advantage of others. Before God, we all have a standard and expectation of how we should live. There's a sense of prophetic authority that God sends people to speak for him to confront others about their sin, right? That's assumed here that's a valid way in which God works in this context. And then it does call for ethical judgment, right? The writer wants us to make a judgment about what happened here. Was this a good thing? Should we just wink and say, oh, yeah, that's interesting? Or should we have a visceral response that says that is wrong and should not be tolerated, and we need to stand against that, right? So these are values. These are beliefs that are embedded in this story that the reader is meant to be influenced by, impacted by, that are meant to be reinforced or instilled in the person who is encountering this story. And it does it in a way that is different than if we just heard the facts, right? So with that in view, then, I want us to explore some worldview messages in popular media, right? And so we're going to do look at two examples. I want to talk about the movie Rogue One. It's one of the Star Wars movies. So let's talk about worldview just for a second. We throw that term around. Some of us are more familiar with it. Some are less familiar with it. But what I mean by worldview is a foundational set of beliefs and values, assumptions, and perspectives that shapes an individual's understanding and interpretation of the world in which they live, right? So all of us have a worldview of one kind or another that is a box that's filled with things that we believe, that we value, that we assume about the world that we live in. And so the question is, how do entertainment, movie, books, music, what are those worldview ideas, beliefs and values in anything that we might encounter? Okay, so this is kind of a case study. So for those of you who aren't familiar with the movie Rogue One, just give a brief summary here. I think I have it in your notes. It unfolds against the backdrop of the Star Wars series. It's really the prequel to the start of the initial Star Wars movies, even though it was produced afterward. It's all about how did they get the plans to the Death Star that's going to destroy the universe if they can't destroy it. Okay, so this is about how Jyn Erso, who's a determined and courageous young woman, becomes a pivotal figure in the Rebels Alliance quest to thwart the construction of the Death Star, a devastating weapon of mass destruction. So assembling a team of rebels with diverse backgrounds and motivations, she embarks on a perilous mission to steal the Death Star's plans. So that's the movie. How many of you have watched that movie? Okay, some of you, how many of you have watched any of the Star Wars movies? Okay, so a majority, not everyone. So here's the question I want us to ask for a minute. What are the beliefs and the values, the assumptions that are embedded in this movie in particular, and if you're not as familiar maybe with the whole Star Wars universe generally? So let's start by talking about what are some positive worldview elements that we encounter in this movie or Star Wars more generally. Any thoughts?
They want to save the world.
Want to save the world? Okay. Yeah, so there's a sense in which the bad things are happening and we want to do something to save the world. What else? Yeah?
He uses a bunch of probably less than savory characters and really gives them an opportunity to redeem themselves and do something good.
Oh, okay.
Using darker people to do something good.
Yeah. Were you gonna say something?
Good and evil, the dark and the light.
Okay, yeah. So there is a sense in which there is good and evil. Talk about the dark side and the light side. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen Rogue One, but in the other Star Wars, there's like multiculturalism. There's many different types of characters that come from. It's not just isolated to like people or from one planet.
Okay.
It's a
So there's a sense of a diversity of society, we should say, and the effort to bring them together for a better world. Just a couple that I noted here. Sacrificial heroism, this idea that you sacrifice yourself for a greater good, for a greater cause, for the betterment of people. The importance of hope. So there is a line where Jen says, rebellions are built on hope, right? So the significance that hope plays in our lives and how we go about living our lives and things that we pursue is a really strong theme in the movie. Resistance against oppression, like that it's a good thing that oppression would be resisted. That's certainly a value that's brought out. The possibility of personal redemption, that, you know, if you have a colored past or a bad history, there's still hope that transformation can take place and you can become a better person and do good things. That's certainly prominent. I think there's also the sense of loyalty to family. The movie kind of starts out with a scene of a family that's in peril and how the father and mother work to save their daughter and what happens to who gets killed and who survives and then how the father, even though he's taken away to enslaved under the dark side to do bad stuff, is still actually loyal to his daughter and his family and his community and how that all plays out in the movie. So those are some positive things. What about some negative worldview elements in Star Wars or this movie in particular? Any thoughts on that? Strong Buddhism, tie that to the movie itself. How does that come up?
I don't super remember this movie, but there's a guy that's basically garbed like a Buddhist monk that is blind and is chanting something about the four. I am one with the force.
And the force is in me.
Thank you.
Right?
So there's and he's a heroic character that takes on, does the impossible and makes it all possible.
Great. So a dominant theme in the movie is the force, right? And the force is neither good nor bad. It's an energy that can be tapped in by the good or the bad and used for either good or nefarious means, right? And so this sense of a dualism between good and evil, a balancing of powers. This is very Eastern in its thought. Eastern spirituality, Buddhism, Taoism. This is embedded more in that kind of a religious philosophy or understanding. Anything else?
The dark side is hate. Like Yoda has this whole thing in Episode 5, I think, where he talks about how that hate. There's love versus hate, so it slips into, it almost feels like Christianity, but then it veers away.
So there's a mingling of themes of love and hate, right and wrong, good and bad, but how that is defined and who's on what side is in question. Yeah, Ryan?
All different, like, you know, sometimes it's necessary they gotta kill somebody, other times they just kill somebody outright. In that one in particular, there's a couple times they just shoot the person, and there's like, you know, like technically, I guess it's because he's going to get killed anyway, but like he just shoots him.
Okay. How is the value of life portrayed in the whole Star Wars saga? What life is valuable? What life can we terminate? Should we care about that or not? Or do we just kind of shrug? There's kind of a wink and even some humor that's incorporated into the killing of people in Star Wars. And so is that okay? You know, is that a value that we should be happy about? So the Force, dualism and morality, the Jedi Order, the whole path to spiritual enlightenment and how that takes place, detachment from material possessions and personal desires, those are all very Eastern and Buddhist mindsets. Let's look at, what about what's lacking in the Star Wars universe? So we can say these are things that are positively affirmed or asserted, but what's not there? You ever thought about that?
Well, here's one for starters. There is no personal divine being, much less a supreme creator of the universe in Star Wars. It doesn't exist. So that's a little bit of a hole in terms of worldview ideas and beliefs, right? What else?
You have to save yourself.
Yeah.
Okay,
so ultimately, salvation is going to come from what you and your comrades can work out, right? The whole, is God present or not?
Just lets loose a cascade of
things that are missing
from the Star Wars universe. So there's no acknowledgement that the state of the world is bad or corrupt because of rebellion or sin against God, because God doesn't exist in that universe. There's no sense of ultimate justice or eternal destiny. There's no developed concept of grace or mercy in that universe. There's no God to dispense grace or mercy in that universe. I don't see that there's really a concept of the stewardship of one's times, abilities, and resources that's in there. There's no accountability that you should be doing this or that with your abilities or resources. And I don't think there's an affirmation of absolute truth. Even though they speak to the light and the dark, good and evil, how that is defined, there's no real basis provided for how that's determined in the Star Wars universe. Okay, so those are assertions about the world just on what is not there, what's not present in the story that's being told. Okay, so, and as is known, George Lucas, who authored all the Star Wars stories, spiritually draws on various spiritual concepts, including Eastern philosophies like Taoism, Buddhism. He's not an adherent to any one religious or spiritual tradition, but he draws on all of it, and it leans Eastern in its orientation. And so that's what you get in the Star Wars movies. Okay, let's take a couple minutes to look at another example. I want us to evaluate the lyrics of the theme song Let It Go from the Disney movie Frozen. So this is, I think it came out in 2016, huge enthusiastic reception globally. It brought in more revenue than the Toy Story movies, which at the time were the big deal. So this is a movie. It's an animated Disney movie that follows the story of two sisters, royal sisters, Elsa and Anna. And Elsa has these magical powers about, cold and freezing things and whatnot. So she does something bad, and the kingdom gets trapped in winter. And so then she goes off on her own. And so Anna, her younger sister, embarks on this journey to try and repair what's been broken and make things better. That's a not very good summary of the movie. But a key figure in this story is Elsa. And so the most popular song is this song called Let It Go. How many of you have heard the song or are familiar with the song? Okay, a majority of you, I think. Okay, so we're going to try, and I don't think it's going to play from my PowerPoint, which it did nicely, but Lynn's going to try and bring it up for me. You want to try and do that, Lynn? So, no, you don't want me to sing it. That would not make the point if I sing it. So listen to this, and I want you to be asking the question, make observations about how the lyrics of the song align or don't align with a biblical worldview, okay? So let's take a couple minutes to listen to this. Go ahead, Lynn. Thanks.
So much to the point where you just rebel and ignore, your morals and values that, you were raised to have. And some of them could be good, but you're just so angry, you build a wall and just shut everything else out.
Okay.
Instead of going to God. And
so it's a song about what's going on in her heart and what she ultimately gives herself to do, and the rejection of the past and family and expectations with that, and a pursuit of the new frontier. Good. What else?
it's a stripping of all the rules. There's the line, there's no rules for me, I'm free, so there's that live. There's, on the one hand, the critique of like where she's been hampered to be, kept from being herself entirely, which is wrong, but then she has this incorrect response in this song saying that, all right, we're going to blow the whole thing up, I'm just going to do whatever I want, which she soon discovers is not the way to go about it, but this song in itself kind of illustrates that point.
Yeah, great. So there's an explicit contrast, a step that's being taken where no more good girl, right, which is associated with how she was living in her family context and expectations about what was good and right. So it's like, no more that. And now I'm moving to a life where there's no rules, no right or wrong, gonna do what I wanna do. Okay, good. Anything else? Yeah.
It's all about her.
Yep.
It doesn't, Nicole never bothered me, so who cares if we have a blizzard that ruins the city because, well, I don't know if she knows about yet that the blizzard's ruining the city of Arendelle. But,
yeah, but she's certainly not thinking about it, it doesn't seem, right? So there's a sense of the ultimate orientation is what's good for me without consideration of how that is impacting of others. Yeah, Bryn?
Dress, like in her character, the way she walks, and then she throws it off, undoes her hair, and then she walks with her hips the way she walks. It's like that's a change, and they didn't actually have to throw that in there. But they put that in there, and that was a different thing they're bringing up. So they're making her seductive.
Really great observation. So it's not in the lyrics of the song.
But it's interesting, the song starts, she's in this beautiful but modest gown of a dress, and then at one point it transitions, and it becomes this kind of lacy, semi-transparent, tight figured thing, showing more of her bust, high slit up the dress, and the way she's walking, swinging her hips, right, left, right. That's not on accident, people. It's not like someone stumbled into that, right? Okay? They're making a statement about what it means to stop becoming a daughter and to become a free, liberated woman. And so that's a message. It doesn't necessarily come out in the lyrics, but it's definitely intended to be part of the song as it's visually presented to us. Yeah, good.
And I could sing along. I'm good. I don't know lyrics that well. But it's interesting, though, how it shows the effects of her selfishness and her abandon of her family and what that results in.
Okay.
That's ultimately where the movie gets to, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
It's not like, hey, Elsa, you're doing making good choices. It's like, well, you tried that, and that hurt everyone else.
Yeah.
And alienated you.
Good point. Okay, so what Ben says is this is a key point transition in the movie, but ultimately it doesn't leave it there because the sister pursues her and sort of brings her back into the world. Okay? So, yeah. Good.
It definitely has postmodern sort of feel to it of who you are, who you believe you to be on the inside is more important than anything else.
Okay, yeah. So what you say is true and how you create your world and how you create yourself, that's ultimate truth. It's not necessarily the reality of what's going on out there. And that's a postmodern idea. Okay, well, I'm sure that we could say a lot more there. But I'm going to move on, at least try and get through point three. I won't get to point four, which I'm a little disappointed, but we'll pick it up next week. Why don't you two, individualism over community, autonomy and independent as ultimate, and the embrace of unbridled freedom. You know, that's this song represents that. And it is the keynote song of the movie. Even though there's redemption, even though the story progresses, when people think of the movie Frozen, they think about this song. And this is a song that all your daughters and granddaughters are singing in connection with this song, right? So what are the implications of that? The influence of that? We might not all agree, but I think we have to ask that question. So
there's a man named John Frame. He's a Reformed Presbyterian theologian. He was at Westminster Seminary for a number of years, and more recently at Reformed Theological Seminary out of Orlando, Florida. I was surprised by this, but he falls more on the side of the positive engager spectrum of entertainment, right? So he's more like, yeah, we should be engaged, it's good stuff, but we need to evaluate it. So he's not in the negative, you know, we shouldn't watch movies, do any of that. He's farther down the spectrum than I am. But interestingly enough, he is something of a movie critic, and he has an ebook called Theology and the Movies. And this is what he says in the intro to his book. The worldview is the most important issue in film. That is the element that is most culturally influential, often in a destructive way, and it is often most central to the filmmaker's purpose. I must add that it is simply false to claim that art has nothing to do with messages. Indeed, we are living in a time in which the messages of art are becoming more and more explicit. So, what do you think? Do you agree with that? Overstated? Understated, right, wrong. Okay, I'm seeing some thumbs up and thumbs down. Maybe we don't want to disagree with the theologian, right? You know, that would feel sort of not right in some way. Yeah.
Well, my kids say they just want to listen to it because of the beat or the tune of a song, but they're not really, they don't even know what the lyrics are.
Sure.
And sometimes, while that's true, I don't believe there's no influence there. But he's making the point that there is an influence, there is a message.
Yeah.
And a lot of parents I talk to, they're operating from the, I don't know if it's a worldview, but the perspective that everything's just kind of neutral.
Sure. That okay.
We kind of just get to decide and let our kids decide and navigate what we think on our own. That's, I get a lot
of feedback. Okay, so this is
why this becomes a controversial topic. One of the issues is, what is the real influence? I mean, I'm not really tying into the words of this song. I'm enjoying the experience. It's great emotive music, and it's a great story. And so the question is it influencing the way you think about the world? Is it influencing the way your kids think about the world? Or is it just neutral? It's just entertainment, right? So what John is saying, and I would agree, cultures have always used art and entertainment to instill and reinforce values and beliefs about what is good, what is true, what's right, what is bad. So as a medium, they are built and intended to influence in some way. Now, we might have to ask the question, what is the influence? To what extent is the influence? And is it God-honoring to engage in any way anything that may have some unbiblical worldview? Okay, so those are valid questions. But I would assert that it is incorrect to live in a mindset that says it's not influencing me. So I'm kind of, you know, it doesn't really matter what entertainment choices I'm involved in, because it's just like water off a duck. It's not having an impact on me. I don't think that that's true of anyone who knows media and art and how it functions, and it's not true if you look at what the Bible has to say about things that we choose to set before our eyes and how that connects with desires in our heart and what we do. So, let me just close with this quote. It's not in your notes. And then we'll pick up next week on how to engage entertainment responsibly. So, Abigail Dodds, this is from an article on the Desiring God website, says, "We become what we watch." She says, "Just as college students pay tuition to sit in a classroom and learn from teachers and professors, so we pay tuition every time we enter a movie theater or pay for Hulu or DirecTV. The only difference is that rather than calling the show an education, they are calling it entertainment. By thinking of shows as entertainment rather than education, we assume that we are entering a space free of thinking and therefore free of being influenced. A space where we can suspend reality in favor of judgment, enjoyment. So that's the mentality that is all around you. Maybe that's part of your mentality. I don't know, but we have to think, what are we paying for our entertainment choices, and what is it giving back to us for what we're willing to pay? Well, let me pray for us, and then I'll dismiss this. Father, thank you for this hour that we've had together. I pray that by your Spirit, you would be working in us and shaping us into people who reflect more and more what you, who you are, and who people who delight in what you call good and beautiful and just, God, and that we would see that having an impact on the entertainment choices that we are making for ourselves and our families. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.